Please help me to open the meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change,
with the courage
to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I have asked Natalie to read a portion of Chapter 3 of the book Alcoholics Anonymous.
More about alcoholism. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led at times to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grips of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there has been brief recovery, followed always by a still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe that they are in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do the right-about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to it. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Here are some of the methods we have tried. Drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, never drinking alone, never drinking in the morning, drinking only at home, never having it in the house, never drinking during business hours, drinking only at parties, switching from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wines, agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job, taking a trip, not taking a trip, swearing off forever, with and without a solemn oath, taking more physical exercise, reading inspirational books, going to health parks and sanitariums, accepting voluntary commitment to asylums. Increase the list ad infinitum.
Thank you, Natalie. Now I'd like to turn the meeting over to Tom, who will be our 10-minute speaker.
Hi, I'm Tom, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tom.
And for me, that means that when I take a drink, I have very little control over how much I drink. And that also means that I don't have any control over when I drink. So when I say when I take a drink, I don't always have control over how much I drink. I mean that sometimes, even though I consider myself to be a pretty bad alcoholic, I can still walk into a bar and have one beer and walk out. And that's maybe 1 out of 10 times or 1 out of 20 times. Because I'm sick, I'll use that as an idea or justification that I can drink normally some of the time, which isn't true, right? Right? If you can't drink normally all the time, you can't drink normally. And that's the case for me. And as I said before, it also means, being an alcoholic also means to me that I can't control when I take a drink. So even though I have a lot of consequences from that 9 out of 10 times where I go in to have one beer and end up closing down the bar, and I tell myself that I'm not going to do that anymore, suddenly I find myself doing that again and again and again and again, despite all the consequences, despite all the warnings from people, judges, parents, friends, family, that what you're doing is wrong or bad, it's hurting you. I keep doing it. I keep thinking somehow next time I'll beat the game or next time I'll drink normally. And when I really take a step back and look at how pathological and sick that behavior is, I can get a definition for alcoholism. So that's why I'm here, right? So that's part of why I'm here. You know, I have a background like anybody else, and I'll share a little bit about that. I'm 36 years old. I've been sober about 2.5 years right now. I've been exposed to AA since I was about 18 years old. I went to my first AA meeting, I think, at 18 or 19. I walked in on my own accord. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor, although I don't know who that is. Well, actually, I do. I do know who that is. Is he here? Maybe, maybe not. I try to do service work with other people, and I come to meetings regularly. That's my little AA pedigree. Just a little background about myself. Obviously, if you look around, right, it's a pretty diverse group of people, right? So we're all not going to identify based on age, race, religion, socioeconomic background. So if you hear something that resonates, great. If you don't, there's obviously a lot of people here to choose from who you probably have something in common with. But the important thing is, you know, if you do try to listen to what I'm saying about alcoholism and what I did to kind of save my own life. So anyway, about me, right? My favorite subject, right? I was born in beautiful Cleveland, Ohio in the summer of 1978 on the very anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing. And so, you know, that's a great omen, right? So every year I get to turn on the news on my birthday and just see these Japanese people weeping about the atomic bomb. It's a great way to start your day, right? So my mom was a hippie, really nice lady. We had a cat named Freedom and a dog named Sunshine. And right? My mom was always smoking these funny cigarettes all the time. And she's a really fun lady. She did a lot, you know, just good-natured. She liked to party, liked to party. She ended up becoming a jazzercise instructor. I don't know if anybody remembers that. The leg warmers and the dancing. She did all sorts of stuff. She's a sample lady at the grocery store. She sold these, like, decorative pottery kind of stuff. She did all sorts of crazy stuff when I was a kid. She ended up becoming a psych nurse at the VA, which is also an interesting job. But she really likes that. She's been doing that for a long time. My dad was kind of the yin to her yang. He was a really tough guy, construction worker. You know, when I look at pictures of him when he was younger, he kind of looked like a cross between like Donnie Brasco and Joe Pesci. You know, he's a real kind of like, hey, I'm going to come in and beat your ass kind of guy, you know. But he's colorful. People really liked him. You know, real social guy. We had a lot of big, big, big parties when I was a kid. I remember like hundreds of people in the house. We moved out of this city when I was a kid and moved. My dad made a lot of money working on the Alaskan pipeline, and we bought a house out in the boonies outside of Cleveland. And he used to throw these big raging parties. And around Halloween, I think about this party he would throw every year where we'd have a coffin, a casket in the living room full of dry ice, so it'd be real spooky. There'd be smoke pouring out of it and those things from the Frankenstein movies that would zap up, you know. Everybody having a great, great time, you know. But I also remember from those parties, being a little kid, that late at night things would start to get kind of ugly. You know, there'd be screams and fights, and a lot of the folks that were hanging around were tough cats, as I said before. So, you know, I could see that kind of craziness start to creep in a little bit. So my parents both drank a lot, and they both had a really good time, and I got exposed to a lot of that. And that was my early idea about what socializing was like. So they tried really hard. They tried really hard. Based on where my dad grew up, he grew up in the projects in the other city. His father was an Irish immigrant, complete raging alcoholic. He and my mom really did the best that they could to raise me. They sent me to Catholic school, which I always appreciated. They tried to give me braces, all sorts of stuff like that, you know. But they didn't always have the tools to really kind of negotiate life. And so a lot of times growing up, I kind of felt like there was nobody running the show, you know. I don't know if anybody can relate to that. There was nobody behind the wheel of the car, you know. Things were pretty wild sometimes. I also got the feeling that things aren't always what they seem, right? When you see people's parents and stuff like that, you know, I saw what was going on behind the scenes in my house, so I just assumed back, you know, the other scene, you know, other people had, you know, these double lives too. I also learned that the world's not a safe place, right? Because there was a lot of violence and a lot of heavy-duty stuff, and I won't go into it, but, you know, nobody was doing the mess around sometimes in my house. There's some tough cats coming through there. And I also learned, don't drink, right? Don't drink, because I don't want to end up, you know, I see the good times, I see the bad times, but overwhelmingly, right, I saw some real, real bad stuff. So I don't drink. You know, those are the kind of the ideas I took away from growing up where I grew up. Anywho, we're going to flash forward to the 90s, right? We're out of the Carter era, like the, you know, late 70s, early 80s, and, you know, we're all, you know, remember Take On Me, that song, everybody remember that? We're moving past that. Somebody else is my age. And then we're moving into the 90s. And it's 1993, I'm a sophomore in high school, right? I'm going to this this high school I really like, I have friends, I'm kind of a popular guy. I still don't drink, my friends drink, right? So I knew, hey, I shouldn't be drinking because my whole family's full of alcoholics, but I want to be cool, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to steal a big liter of vodka from my dad's liquor cabinet and see what this is all about. So I did, right? And so did that, stole a big bottle of Kamchatka vodka, just delicious stuff, and we brought it up to my buddy's house, and we were going to mix it with apple juice, which is, you know, does, right? Vodka and apple juice is a real sophisticated cocktail, so... We did. We drank that. And I remember that feeling sitting in there bullshitting with these guys, choking this stuff down. And I turned to talk to somebody, and there was a little slow motion kind of thing that happened, right? And then I felt it come all over me, right? And I felt, oh, this is really kind of cool, right? And that whole night was just great. We got in the car and we were driving around, and we went to we met some girls, and they were bad girls. This girl Julie Robbins and this other girl Megan Quinn, who had half her head shaved and purple hair, and I was like, yeah, this is fucking great. We went to a cemetery and I ended up making out with Julie Robbins, and I fell into an open grave, and everybody thought that was real funny, right? Got a winner. End up going back home, you know, we're walking down the road in the middle of winter, and we see my buddy's dad. He's drunk, he picks us up, right? We're all driving around drunk, you know? A real Ohio moment. And so it was great. That was night one. Woke up the next day, I felt great, right? I thought, do it again. Let's do it again, right? Let's go for it again. So we got the concoction out, we were drinking. I was really going at it this time. We ended up walking around. We ended up running into who else but Julie Robbins. We ran into Wes Robbins, Julie's crazy older brother, right? and then this kid Matt Cavanaugh, who's dead now, and another guy I think who's also dead. We got into it with them. We were over at a house, and Wes used an oven mitt that was in the shape of a cow to beat my ass pretty good, right? So I had this cow coming at me, you know, I'm drunk and dodging it. We got out of there. We went to McDonald's. I got something to eat. That night I started feeling sick. They had my buddies had to drag me home and throw me in the shower, and it was a mess. So that was night two, right? Night one, really good time. Night two. Or day two, not so great with the drinking, right? And so that was my drinking career, you know. Sometimes I would have a good time, and the other times bad shit would happen. And over time, right, like all of us who are probably here, the bad stuff really, really started to outweigh the good. So between that day in 1993 and the present, a lot has happened. I'm not going to try to explain any of it, but I've had a pretty interesting life. Most of that time, I've been sober. I realized pretty early on I had an alcohol problem. And I ended up going to an AA meeting at 18 or 19, as I said. And since then, most of the time I've been sober, but I only had 2.5 years of sobriety. So in between that time and now, let's see what I'm just going to run through some of the stuff that I've done. I had 2 DUIs before I was 21. Fought the cops, was arrested multiple times. That's pretty cool, right? Worked with mobsters and steel mills. I was railroaded into the military by a judge. Also a great time, right? Lived in Japan for a while. First of my family to finish college. I took the Trans-Siberian Railroad once. I almost died of dysentery in India. Fell in love. Became a stock analyst. I was an IRS agent for a while. I was a bouncer. Visited Hezbollah territory in Lebanon. Learned to speak pretty good Mandarin. I was in China for a couple years. Went to Carnival in Rio. Worked as a day laborer in Chicago. I've done a lot of different things, right? Pretty interesting life. Most of that stuff I've done sober, right? So if anybody ever tells, if you have an idea about life is going to be boring and glum if I get sober, that's really not the case. What's really boring when you step back and look at it is sitting in that basement watching Jon Stewart getting high by yourself, right? Or going to the same bar and doing the same thing over and over again with the same people every night. That's the boring stuff. How am I doing on time?
You're pretty...
Okay. So anyway, I'm going to skip ahead. So what happened, right? I'll be real brief about this, right? I had about 7.5 years of sobriety. I was in graduate school. A lot of bad stuff happened. I decided to drink again after 7.5 years. And let me, with the caveat, my own internal caveat, that if I start to get out of control, I know where to go and I know what to do. I'll just put down a bottle and go back to AA, right? Bad idea, right? Super bad idea. I relapsed to such an extent that the physical manifestations of the disease this time really caught up. And I was very, 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 very sick. Very, very, very sick before long. But, and I got to hurry up and run through this, so I'll jump forward. What I did was, and for anybody who's struggling in and out of the rooms, I could not stay sober despite my best efforts, and I was literally drinking myself to death. But I kept calling people. I kept coming to meetings. I kept trying to keep in touch with AA, and I had that lifeline of that tether, and then I ended up getting sober again over time. But it took a long time. It caused me a lot of pain, a lot of anguish. I lost a lot in my life. So if you're thinking about drinking again, I'll shut up right after this. I was sitting at a bar in Washington, D.C., with a non-alcoholic beer in front of me, and debating whether or not to drink again, right? There was a guy standing next to me, and I turned to him and I go, "Yeah, I'm thinking about drinking again." And I noticed he wasn't drinking. It's a dive bar in D.C. And he says, "Oh yeah, well he just so happened to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous." Huh. What are the odds of that, right? That you're sitting there wrestling over that at a bar. And he said to me, "Whatever reasons you quit drinking for in the first place are very likely still valid today, and that's all I can tell you." Of course, I drank and, you know, destroyed my life. But that's what I'll leave you with today. But there's a lot of hope and there's a solution here, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak. Thanks.
I would like to now turn the meeting over to our main speaker, Barbara P.
Thank you. Wow. I have a few notes. My name is Barbara P. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Barbara.
Wow. Thank you for your share, too. I'm going to go back further. Around the 60s and 70s, 80s. You know, chapter 5 says how it works. You know, it says, "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves over to the simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves, they are such unfortunate. They are not at fault, however, they seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of developing a manner of living that requires that demands rigorous honesty." And it says, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. Wow, so I was just thinking about that, you know. I reflected back over my life and what I was like before I got here. You know, I am similar to, you know, we all have different stories and different experience. You know, I'm the oldest of 6 children. And I had the responsibility of caring for my younger siblings where my parents worked. We migrated to California when I was 2. My family's from Texas. We moved here. My mom came with 2 children. And she was single mom, unwed mother. And her sisters were here, living here. And they were married and had children. Well, one aunt didn't have any children, the other one did. So we all lived in this big, happy family. And there was always parties going on in that house, you know, and, you know, drinking going on and all kind of stuff, you know. I recall, and my mom, she wasn't really a partier, but, you know, they're from a family of 14 children. And see, my mom is an ACA, adult child of alcohol. My grandfather was an alcoholic, and 3 of her siblings, out of the 14 children, 6 of her siblings were alcoholic. And then my biological dad was an alcoholic, so, you know, that set the stage for me to you know, and little did I know, we didn't discuss the alcoholism, and, you know, everything was normal. We thought this is normal stuff. You know, alcohol is sociably acceptable, so it was normal for them to party. It starts at 5 o'clock on Fridays and ends on Sundays. So, you know, we learned that, you know, this is what we do. You know, you grow up and you start your party. So, you know, we lived there for a while together, and everyone was okay except for this one uncle. You know, he was the perverted one who was, was kind of abnormal, did abnormal things. So, but we all lived together. My mom married my stepdad, and about 2 or 3 years after we had moved here, she met him, and she got pregnant with her third child. She came here with 2 children, and then she met him and was having her third. So we moved out, and I remember them having a party, and in the house, it was a birthday party, and the next day it was glasses everywhere, and I get up and I'm sipping all the glasses. I'm going around tasting everything, you know, and I never really thought anything about it, you know, and that went on, and it passed over. Then later, as I became a teenager, things happened in between there, but things that led up to my alcoholic behavior and just really really becoming destructive in my life. But as a teenager, I did what teenagers do, mischievous things. And my girlfriend and I, we didn't have anything else to do. So we decided one day we were going to put our money together and buy some wine. Now, we teenagers, and we're not old enough to buy wine, so we're going to get someone to go buy the wine for us. So we go to the liquor store, and of course, we do have other things we could have done, you know, but here, I'm preparing for my future. So we go to the store, we get someone to buy the wine, and the it was white port and lemon juice. So we go to my friend's house, and we commence to drink. So we done drunk the wine, and we were falling out, and we thought that was fun, you know, it was just fun. And so I had to go home, and I remember walking home. I didn't live too far from her, and I felt a little dizzy and nauseous. I got home, went straight directly to my room, and laid down in the room spinning around, I recall. I don't know if my mom knew I had been drinking. She never said anything, but as I was reflecting on that experience, I don't recall where her parents were. You know, all through my life, I don't remember where any of my friends' parents were. You know, but I do recall at that time, everyone was drinking and partying. You know, parents were leaving the kids, you know, and they're doing their own thing. So we were just kind of taking care of our own selves, you know, growing up. And that was around the 60s, parents' work. And it was a different era. We didn't have the soccer moms and all the stuff we have now, you know. We could leave our doors open, and, you know, we could go walk around. So anyway, that went over well, and I said, oh, we got away with that. Didn't get caught. So then, you know, I did a lot of things as a teenager, you know, that led up to my disease. We would, on weekends, I look forward to meeting with my friends, and we would meet up and decide what we were going to do for the weekend. And see, my mom came to California when I was 2 years old. And so I grew up in Oakland, and so we decided one Saturday, said, well, what are we going to do today? And they said, oh, I know, why don't we go to West Oakland? I was living in East Oakland, so we're going to hitchhike a ride to West Oakland instead of taking public transportation, you know, and we just never had anything better to do. And so we hitchhiked, and the guy gave us a ride, so he stopped at the store and buy us beer. You know, again, we get alcohol, you know, this is... So we get to West Oakland, and he decided that he'd drive up to an empty lot, and we got scared, like, where is he taking us? And so we tried to jump out of the car, and the doorknobs fell off, you know. And so we always getting ourselves in a precarious situation, you know. So we got out of the car, throwing beer, you know, and said, wow, we won't do that again. you know, we just did crazy stuff. I would cut school, and, you know, we have cutting parties where we're drinking. Everything around my life is around alcohol and drinking, and, you know, I didn't really realize that until later, that this was setting the stage. You know, I was already predestined, and my seat was already here, you know, waiting for me. so we my girlfriend, or my best friend, told me not to cut school, and I said, well, I'm going to do it anyway. And she called my parents and pretend she was a school secretary and told her I cut school. And so I was so furious, so I got in trouble. So anyway, you know, I was occasionally drinking. It was sporadic, and it hadn't gotten that bad. But, you know, these are all the little things that's happening in between. And so in high school, continued to drink. Well, see, with me, I grew up, I was real I was shy. I had a speech impediment, so it's kind of like what they describe as tongue-tied. And, you know, I didn't think that I was, you know, all that pretty. You know, I had a gap in my teeth. I was not needed, and had red hair, and so I was called Red, you know, and it's all these nicknames. So I was really shy growing up, so what I discovered, alcohol gave me courage. You know, when I didn't drink, I was quiet and I was in the background. And I was teased a lot, too, coming up, you know, because of my speech. I couldn't pronounce certain words, so I had to go to speech therapy. So as a teenager now growing up, I'm shy. So alcohol gave me the courage. So one day I took this alcohol and was at a party, and I just said something really profound at this party, and everyone like, that's Barbara. You know, I said, wow, you know. So then I learned that, you know, take a few drinks before you go out, or prepare yourself before the party, you know. So, I mean, it was on now, you know. So I'm the popular person now, and so it just continued to get worse, and my life is spiraling down. I was pretty smart coming up in elementary. I read a lot, you know. I was in spelling bees, but now my life has changed. But I believe my life changed basically because I had a very strict mother. And my mother was loving, and I was confused about it until today. I learned a lot through AA about the addiction, the dysfunctional families that we think is normal, and mental illness. You know, I had no idea all this stuff was going on in my family. My mother was so strict, but she was insane. You know, she was raging and complaining all the time. You know, we never did anything good enough. We had to clean. She was a compulsive cleaner. You know, everything was clean and spotless. And so on weekends, I really couldn't go anywhere until I cleaned up the house. And I would get up early because I need to get out of the house and get away from her. And so, but, you know, I need to get out before she went to do her inspection, because if it wasn't white, I had to come back and do it. So, anyway, she, what I learned in the program is that my mom was really unhappy. And I think that sets the stage also for me looking for some type of escape, you know. Even today, you know, she never validated us, never complimented us. Everything was always something's wrong. And I could describe my mom's personality as being narcissistic. You know, she couldn't put her, you know, it wasn't about how you feel today. You know, and still today she doesn't do that. You know, and so it kind of makes me crazy, but I have to have a lot of compassion for her. You know, when we come into the program, usually our family, when we change, the family stays sick. And if they don't get treatment, they get worse, for the most part, you know. And then also, she's already ACA, you know, she had the disease in the family, but her dad was alcoholic, crazy. And so her relationships, you know, relationships never worked out, even with my stepdad, you know. I remember him always leaving. And, you know, the other thing is that the communication, we didn't learn how to communicate in our home. When they were angry, no one talked. You would walk around trying to figure out what's going on, you know. So, you know, it was just all crazy and insane in our family. And when I came, by the time I came in the program, I would listen to people and learn about the dysfunction of the families, mental illness, and sometimes they may have to go be treated. And as I continue, you know, things with this pretty much the same way. I would run away from home, leave home sometimes. I really wouldn't run away. I would leave when my mother was on that rampage, you know, where she was angry and screaming and yelling, and always tried to get away, had to find a place to go and leave. And I would go over a friend of ours' house and stay, and she would come looking for me. she didn't like any of my friends. My mother didn't like my friends. They were never good enough. We were never good enough. So the thing was, I believe it was all her stuff that she wasn't good enough. So it was projected out in her anger. Whatever happened to her and my biological dad when she took us away, it was probably still causing her pain. And whatever went on during her life growing up, of course, from the South, being from families of situations that wasn't, the best, I continued to dream. In my senior year in high school, going to parties and hanging out with my friends, I had a child, same as my mother. I had a child at a wedlock. Didn't get married. Ended up raising my son as a single mom. Just like parents then, our children aren't in our life because we're too busy drinking and doing our drugs and having parties. So we find a place for the kids to be quiet, in the television or in the room. I became a waitress, so I was in the right place. and a bartender, so I didn't drink while I was working, but after the bar closed, that's when our party starts, so I would drink at night and sleep late during the day. And that's just the way things were, that was just normal. I thought it was normal. But as the disease progressed, I started having problems. I left that job. I did a geographic, went to L.A., stayed with my cousin. Alcohol again was there. The insanity was there. She tried to commit suicide and cut her wrist, and I just couldn't stand to be there. I had to leave. I went to stay with another cousin, and we're still drinking and the drugs. Now we've progressed to other drugs such as mescaline and acid and all that, So I'm in. we've added this, and I moved to Hollywood too. Moved to Hollywood, so we're acting a fool, crazy. And so my cousin, I remember her telling me, Barbara, here, you ought to try this. I'm like, I don't think so. Anyway, I took a little teeny piece of acid, and they were all outside acting crazy, and I said, I'm gonna stay in the room. I'm not going out there. I'm in this room, and the worst experience I had was to take some this acid, and I'm watching television, and it was Smokey the Bear on this commercial, and I was like, I mean, this is crazy, and I was so afraid. I'd never been that afraid in my life. The room catching on fire, and I was afraid to move. I'm in the corner, And I told her, I said, I'm not going to ever do that again, And they just thought I was really a square, I left. Yeah, I needed to come back to Oakland. I said, I'm going back home because it was such a fast pace. So I come back into my normal environment, not all that insanity, the drug. Got a few jobs, continued to drink, and the drinking continued to get me in trouble. The drinking started getting worse, and where I was starting to have, end up in the hospital, going to a party, just a simple party, and I go home. My sister is in trouble, so I'm trying to save her. I end up in the hospital because I am trying to knock on the window to get the person's attention that had her in the house, and end up cutting my main artery, and they had to rush me to the hospital, and they didn't know if I was going to live, but I lived through that. I'm still here because, I still have some more research to do. I have, some more things to finish. I had just got a new job, and You know, and throughout my drinking experience, I lost a lot of jobs. We talked about losing jobs. Had a lot of great jobs, but I couldn't hold on to jobs. You know, we said that they get in our way, but, you know, the drinking. And so I just continued to spiral down. And well, what happened later, I started working this job where, you know, my friends, they thought I was a great driver when I drank. So I was always nominated the driver, and I thought I could drive too. I was a great driver, you know, just give me a few drinks. So I could drive, you know. I thought I was the best driver in the world. And so I ended up having a few DUIs. a hit and run, which I didn't get away. I'm thinking I can get away. Didn't realize I had some flat tires. And couldn't, you know, didn't know why the car wouldn't move. I mean, it was just insanity. I was working this one job. I worked in Colgate in Berkeley. They closed many years ago. And everyone drank. We drank after work. We drank during our lunch. You know, it was just a wonderful, big, happy family. So I had hit my bottom. I had hit the first bottom, and I got depressed. And my sister's friend told me that I might have a problem with alcohol, you know. So he suggested I see his friend, who was a doctor, and she talked about alcohol and the disease, and she suggested I go into a 30-day program. And I thought about it because, you know, the remorse, the shame, and, you know, looking at everything that's happened, how my life was turning out. I went into the program, and I stayed 30 days, and went to a couple of meetings, and I went back to work, and my coworker said, oh, you know, nothing's wrong with you. You know, you just need to stop drinking that what you're drinking and change, you know, and stop mixing your drinks, and you'll be okay. And so I was gradually picking up where I left off. I went back to drinking, and it took me about 8 years before I finally got back to the program. Jails, you know, they're talking about prison, and you know, the consequences of our drinking. You know, I checked myself into a, you know, I thought I was going crazy. You know, I checked myself into a Herod hospital then. I said, oh, you know, something's wrong with me. I just can't figure out what's wrong. You know, so I never told the doctor I was drinking. You know, I just couldn't figure out, you know, what was wrong. So he said, well, they checked me in, and around from the hospital was a happy hour bar. So I had the freedom of coming and going whenever I wanted to, and I had free parking, and I could stay there. And so in happy hour, I'd go around and have me some drinks. And then go back into the hospital and watch TV and lay around. It was the insanity. And one day the nurse said, Barbara, she said, come here. She said, what's wrong? You know, why are you here? I said, I just needed a break. I needed to see the And so she said, wow, that was interesting. She sat down and talked to me and told me that maybe I should just go on home you know, that maybe that wasn't the place for me. So the next day, the doctor came to see me. You know, he rarely saw me, but he came. He said, Barbara, he said, I think you self-destructed, you know, so you need to leave. We're going to check you out. But he never did talk about my, you know, what was really going on with me. He just said I was self-destructive. And I said, so go home and destroy yourself. I'm going to do it here. So I was upset with them, and I ended up having to go back home. And, I continued to drink, and things continued to get worse, and the DUIs got worse, and I had met a guy where I'm working, and I ended up having a child, a baby, and I think that really hit me when the baby died. And I went into a great depression because I went full term. They didn't tell. I was never told that anything was wrong until I got ready to give birth. And they said that they were going to have to take the baby. And But they told me what was the problem. They said I had a choice, and the choice that I took, he said, well, you know, if the baby lives, it's going to be a vegetable, so, you know, you shouldn't be stuck with that responsibility. And I felt really bad because I felt I needed to trust God, and I didn't. I said, you know, I can't do this. I never told anyone what the real truth about what had happened. But all through my pregnancy, I drank and I partied, so I felt responsible. I felt really guilty, and I felt a lot of shame. And, you know, it was just this really awful feeling that I had to go through, this secret that I had to carry. And I couldn't be around people with children for a long time. And I couldn't talk about me and what happened. And my family really didn't ask me what happened. And it was so recently when I finally told them what it really happened and what was wrong with the baby. The baby was born hydrocephalus, and they had to end up taking. But I continued to drink. I got a DUI. I had an attorney. He got me out of that situation because he told the judge what had happened. So the judge felt really a lot of compassion for me. So he told me, okay, you know, just go to this DUI class and everything is okay. And, you know, he just gave me a little slap on the hand and, you know, that was it. And so I resumed my own life. A couple of times I got stopped. The police, this is before the mother gets drunk driving, really got really serious about this drinking and driving. The Oakland police sometimes I would get stopped and they'd take me home or they'd call someone to come pick me up, you know. And but later they didn't do it anymore because see they couldn't let us, well, you know, let us loose the way we were because they were responsible. So my second DUI, I had to go to AA meetings. I was required to go to AA meetings. So I did go to meetings. I went to the in-between, which is my home group, and I would sit in the back of the room, and I wouldn't say anything. And I had my wine at home cooling in the refrigerator. I couldn't wait till the meeting was over so I could go back to my life, you know, and think. And I wasn't paying attention to what these people were talking about, you know. You know, I didn't have a problem. I just needed to be able to work. I just needed some R&R and, you know, just keep doing my life, you know. Before long, I had my third DUI, and this time I thought I was going to get away with it, but the judge saw that I was not going to get off of this one, and I decided that I wanted a jury trial. And, you know, they told me to, you know, I can plead a, you know, do a plea, but I said, no, I want a jury trial because they are not right. I'm not guilty, you know, and I don't even remember what happened. So anyway, I have the jury trial, and, you know, you select your jury, and I happen to select this woman. I thought that she'd be great on my, as one of my jurors, because her brother was an alcoholic, and she couldn't stand her brother. And I chose her to be on the jury, and you know what? I was found guilty, and I was sentenced. I was sentenced to 6 months in Santa Rita Jail. The judge waived 3 years. He told me if I ever got caught again, he was going to send me to prison for 3 years. And, you know, that was so shameful. Again, that's my secret. I'm going to tell my family what happened. I never told them I was going to court for, you know, just about getting ready to go to jail. You know, I'm showing up at court and going through the motions. And so they remanded me into custody right then. And so they knew something had happened when I didn't show up home. Like, I had a son. He shows up at home and his mother doesn't show up. You know, he had to move all my stuff and put it in storage. And he had to move with my parents, you know. And then his dad took him. I ended up being in Santa Rita. And for 6 months, I wrote the judge and told him that, you know, how I was doing. And I was really sorry, and I learned a lot. And he said, good, because you're going to need everything you learn when you get out. Because he wasn't going to give me no time, time for good behavior. I ended up doing the full, ended up doing 4 months, so I got out. A boyfriend of mine had picked me up, and he told me, he said, you know, nothing's wrong with you. He said, stuff. So before long, anyway, what happened was I got out. He brought the me liquor, and I drank, and I was right back where I started, and it was on again. And my sister told me, I went to my sister's house, and she said, you know, Barbara, she said, if you want help, you know, you can come go to a meeting with me tonight. Go to a meeting. And I was so, you know, I was just completely bankrupt spiritually, physically, and emotionally. She said, go to a meeting, and I went to the meeting, and I was so willing to go to, you know, they said, if you want what we have, you go to England. And I went, and I was ready. I was ready. I think at that point, I was ready. That night, I heard what I needed to hear. A person had, a drunk driver killed someone. And I heard that, you know, if that could have been me, thank God that I had not killed anyone. And I cried. I just cried, and I was scared, and I didn't know how I was going to get through this program. But they told me it's a one-day-at-a-time program, you know, get a sponsor, do 30 meetings. And I just grabbed on with dear life. I just, you know, I just held on. And I went to meetings. I was ready to follow all directions and instruction because I knew that I could not do this on my own. So I did get a sponsor, which I still have the same sponsor. As I said, I've been here 28 years, one day at a time. It's been a long journey. My life has changed. You know, I still struggle. I still have problems. But the thing is, I don't drink, and I don't have to drink over the problem. I can go through life. I have financial problems. I have family problems. I have all kind of situations that I encounter and challenges. But I don't have to drink behind it. I remember where I've been last night. This program is wonderful. I got into service. I did a lot of service in my early sobriety. I didn't know how to have relationship with people then. I do now. I'm really a talker now, and I'm not really shy. I had a lot of stuff to say, but, you know, it's kind of fed up to hear. But, you know, for those of you who are new, I do want to read one thing, though, and it's the promises. I love the promises. And what the promises tell us is that we don't have, you know, if you're painstaking about the phase of our development, we'll be amazed before we are halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not want to regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will know how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly. They will always manifest, and we work for them. Thank you.